everyone. Welcome to the second episode of Season 2 of The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. As always, I'm your host, Jason Franklin, and returning for Season 2 today, we have the Reverend Dixon Kinzer and Dr. Mark Audrey Graves. Hi, friends.
Hi.
Good morning, evening, afternoon, whatever time you
you're
are
starting
listening.
Strong,
he's
Mark.
He's going to do good his day. Entire story monosyllabically.
And a good day to you.
You should do it in Spanish.
No, yes.
Si podría, si quieres.
Mark, welcome back.
Thank you.
How does it feel to be back for Season 2?
You know, it's great to be back. I feel like it has been quite some time, and yes. While I'm concerned that I might be a little rusty, I feel like I'm coming in with such a strong story case person here.
Oh, I love that.
That I shouldn't be concerned about any rustiness.
I think you shouldn't be concerned one bit.
Is Courtney Cox your Episcopal layperson? It's not going to cut it.
Listen, you know, funny you should mention Courtney Cox, but... No.
Here's the thing. I'm counting on Mark being rusty because I've lost every single.
You have not lost every.
I haven't lost every?
No. There are some that you're not listening. I'm sure of it. Could I tell you specifically? No. But
easier to find the ones I've lost and the ones I've prevailed.
You know what I noticed with you, Dixon, on the polls? It's always, you always start off behind, and then as longevity-wise, you start to gain momentum.
Okay, so, yeah. So I'm like a slow burn.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That's what
or
you
it's
are.
Like a pity thing where, like, poor guy.
Slow burn, Dixon. how are you feeling, Dixon? So for those of you listening, we are recording two episodes today, and Dixon is doing double duty. Are you ready for this marathon?
I think so. I think I'll be raspier next round, but that's just cool. I'm just going to steer into the kind of Kim Carnes thing with the whole deal. And
are you going to see? Are you going to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart?
I 100% am going to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart.
I am ready for it.
I'm turning this off.
So, we are doing a little mini-series for the next few episodes that I am calling The Ministers of the Church. The Book of Common Prayer says that the ministers of the church are laypersons, bishops, priests, and deacons. And this week we are covering the most interesting layperson in Episcopal Church history. Dixon, some listeners may be surprised to think of laypeople as a minister of the church. Why do you think that the Book of Common Prayer defines ministers of the church this way?
The great promise of the Church of England was a flat ecclesiastical structure where you've got bishops, priests, and deacons, and the laity, really the orders of ministers, you know, the ordained people and laity, they're all functioning together. Just with different purposes, you know, so it's not so much like there's a better or worse or a hierarchy of, you know, holiness, but good order, certain roles, you know, I know what's in my lane, you know what's in your lane, and we work together to accomplish and be the church, the work of the church and be the church together in the world. And so that's why lay people are as much a minister of the church as anyone that's ordained, you know, because they have particular work. Like there's a work for the laos, for the people to do that is not for clergy to do. But it's interesting because Mark was sassing me about, he's like, hey, lay people, Mark, that's my lane. I know the laity. And I was like, I have not surrendered my participation in the laos as a clergy person. But it's true because the liturgy means work of the people.
Yeah.
And that's that word, laos, again. And we, what we do together, clergy, lay, all of us on Sundays, is the public work for the redemption of the world at the private cost of our time, energies, talents being formed by this Jesus story together. So we are all part of that great laos together.
I love that. And Mark, as the layperson, how do you see the role of lay people in the church?
I mean, I could be flippant and say what he said, and in large part, I mean, that's exactly it. And you know, it is great credit to our prayer book, our current prayer book, that takes the space and time to lay that out in such a clear way.
Yeah.
And if you notice, lists the laity first in that list of the baptized.
Yes.
Because it does, it all flows from baptism. Mm. And as Martin Luther would say, now Martin Luther is not an Anglican. We all know this.
He wishes
Martin
he
Luther
was.
Martin Luther knew that. He wishes he was.
As we get angry Lutheran emails.
Yes. But one of the stories I love best about Luther was anytime his way of dealing with temptation, when he knew that, in the way he phrased it, when Satan was in his face, his response was always to say, "I am baptized." Mm. And that was a gift he gave to all of his people
right.
in his churches. And the rest of us, by association, that, yeah. that is to claim that baptism is the fundamental claim of Christianity and of the church. And that precedes any holy orders that then flow in the life of the church for its good order. Hmm.
Is it fair to say that I know I would say this personally, but like that the prayer book, particularly the 79, has a much higher view of baptism than it does ordination. Hmm.
Yes, which is why the one gripe I have,
yes.
my liturgical,
just one.
One of my primary liturgical gripes with our current prayer book is therefore the rubric to applaud at an ordination is misplaced.
Okay.
I like that.
And where
it should
rubric.
Go with baptism instead.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's also why anytime there's a baptism at St. Paul's, I'm so glad I get to get this in.
should see his smile on his face, listeners.
Anytime that a child or adult is baptized, you might hear one particularly loud amen coming from the choir stalls.
Okay.
That's for me. I was actually taught by a professor in seminaries. Shout out. If you're listening to the, if the very reverend Dean Timothy Kimbrough, my liturgy professor, happens to be listening.
Indeed, he is not listening. But. Timothy, but you're not listening.
That is the most important amen in the liturgy.
Yeah.
Is the amen at a baptism.
Yeah, wow.
And he taught us all. He said, say it loudly. So therefore,
like yeah.
since we don't get to applaud there, we can least say amen very loudly.
Next time you're at ordination with Mark, you listen for that.
I think I'm not going to belabor that, but I say also, dear listener, if you're here at St. Paul's, don't skip baptisms.
No, absolutely
don't
not.
Be
absolutely
like, oh, no. Baptism, we got to get out of here. No, this is like, it's central to who we are.
Right.
It's how we know it's who we are.
There's something that I love about the communal aspect of the baptism.
This is the right move.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled it back center. Yeah, really good.
So I checked last season, and you both were on one episode together. Mm-hmm. Do you all remember what it is?
Oh, yes. Oh, it was not unlike this one.
I know. That's what I think was interesting. The most revolutionary Anglican.
I chose an ordained person for that
one. And this is the other funny thing, because you chose Desmond Tutu, and Dixon, you chose C.S. Lewis.
I did, yeah.
So that's an interesting switcheroo there. Any guesses on who got the most votes for the episode?
Mark, just by virtue of how it usually goes.
Give a straight face. Mark, you are winning.
All right, there you go.
And not to take you down another notch, Dixon, but I'm sorry to say you don't have a single vote.
Come on.
I would have voted for C.S. Lewis.
People are canceling C.S. Lewis right now. There's this whole move to cancel him.
It's because he didn't like hymns.
It's canceled.
Let's be honest. It's because he didn't like hymns in church.
I'm just kidding. Dear listener, no one's canceling C.S. Lewis. I'm just not as good at this as Mark is.
All of that is to say, if you disagree with those votes, you should listen to the episode from season one and make sure and vote on Spotify.
Vote for Dixon.
I think it's time to let our two guests present their case. We'll talk about it a little bit. And after the episode, you can vote on who told the most compelling story. Dixon, would you like to kick us off for this episode?
I would love to.
Take it away, my friend.
Okay. It may come as no surprise to you, but I think the most interesting Episcopal layperson is Ralph Adams Cram.
Not a surprise to anyone in this room.
Not a surprise.
Right?
Not a surprise.
The more I learn about this guy, the more I'm like, love this guy. Also, the more I learn about this guy, the more I'm like, oh, he had some problematic views. Oh, but so did everybody. We're not going to talk about that as much today because that's not what makes him interesting.
Before you begin, though, for the listeners who aren't from St. Paul's or aren't super familiar, why are we not surprised that you picked Ralph Adams Cram?
Well, part of what we'll come to in this is that he is, Cram is a church architect who designed and built the current iteration of St. Paul's in 1928 in Winston-Salem.
Currently in.
Yes. Yes, or next to,
next
as
to.
It were.
I was thinking about that.
We sometimes have recorded these in that building.
Yes.
But yes, yeah, Cram's a church architect, and he was a particular kind of church architect, which I think helps frame him and some of why I think he's interesting, not just because he built our building, but let me do a little history. So basically he's born in 1863 in New Hampshire. And at the age of 18, he moves to Boston to work for 5 years in an architecture office because this is what he wants to do. And basically he leaves to go to Rome to study classical architecture. And anyone that's geeky, actually, I mean, you could probably speak to this as an architect yourself, Jason. I think there's a path a lot of people take, and Rome is like one of the places. Mm-hmm. If you're nerdy about architecture and passionate, you go.
Yeah.
And so Cram goes there. And in 1887, he is at a Christmas Eve mass, midnight service, and he has this like really dramatic conversion experience, like Pentecostal level conversion. You know, oh my gosh, Jesus is real. My life is radically changed. Like, if an evangelical was like, can you tell me the day, date, and time of your conversion? He's like, Christmas Eve, 1887, right? Nice. But he becomes in that moment converted, not just to Jesus Christ, which is the most important, but very passionately into Anglo-Catholicism. Mm-hmm. He becomes an ardent supporter of that way of being Christian, which is essentially, dear listener, taking the mode of worship in the Church of England, but reintegrating into it many of the Catholic practices that were stripped out during the Reformation. This is happening to him sort of in the wake of the Oxford movement happening in England, which is our recatholization of faith, which interestingly enough was not about fussy liturgics, but about serving the poor. Just side note. And so basically he becomes this like converted Anglo-Catholic. He comes back to the United States. He marries Elizabeth Carrington Reed in Massachusetts, which I wanted to mention because he had three kids. And just for the time frame, her dad had been a Civil War general, which you're like doing the math. Oh yeah. At 1900. Yeah, sure. Huh. He was totally. Yeah. 100%. So that's just an awkward father-in-law to have.
Yeah.
Just to say. So Cram ultimately, after he's married, makes it back to Boston and joins with business partner Charles Wentworth and starts an architectural firm in 1889, Cram and Wentworth. They landed only 4 or 5 commissions until they were joined by Bertram Goodhue, who was another very, you might know his name, ends up becoming a famous architect in his own right. But in 1892, Cram, Wentworth, and Goodhue are formed, and they get a major break when their firm is selected to design the Military Academy at West Point in 1902. That becomes their kind of entree into the world of very significant architectural commissions in the United States. They do colleges, they do churches a lot, they do homes, and basically Cram and Goodhue are like the preeminent talents in the firm, okay? Lennon McCartney, you know, kind of thing. Bono and the Edge, except they're like competitive. So maybe they're like Noel and Liam Gallagher. And essentially there's a lot of like kind of sparring and infighting between them. After the West Point Commission, they've got enough success that they open a New York office where basically Goodhue presides in New York, Cram presides in Boston, which is why when they enlist Cram to do St. John the Divine Cathedral in 1911, and he takes that commission, there's a bristling, like, oh, he's on Goodhue's territory, right? They very much had that. Side note, dear listener, Bertram Goodhue's nephew, Wright Goodhue, designed the Passion window that is over our high altar.
Right.
He's one of the great stained glass architects, and his life was cut short. And he was, I think, meant to do all of the windows in our nave. But that's another side note. So basically, Cram and Goodhue, they spar, they complement each other's strengths, but eventually they split. And Cram kind of continues his work solo. You would know some of Cram's work, dear listener, because he, in addition to doing West Point, also was a supervising architect for Princeton University. The chapel there is exclusively his design. He also did other famous chapels you might know, St. Paul's, like All Saints Chapel in Suwanee. We've already mentioned St. John the Divine in New York City, but also when he was with Goodhue, they did St. Thomas Fifth Avenue, which is, people say that's the most coherent work they had together. So it's like there's just a ton of things. Oh, he did the original campus at Rice University, which is interesting because he was like, Houston's really humid.
Yeah.
And so he picked a neoclassical Italian design sensibility to do that space because it looks different than Princeton. Now, here's the thing. What does Princeton look like? What does our St. Paul's look like? What does St. John the Divine look like? They all are Gothic.
Yeah.
And Cram is a neo-Gothic revivalist. That's what he's known for. And he really believed that Gothic architecture was the best architecture for buildings of significant formation. So churches, yes. Universities, yes. He implemented it all over. They did MIT, by the way. That's another one they did. And if you don't know what a Gothic architecture is, basically a Gothic architecture comes from the Gothic arch, which is a pointed arch. So it's an arch that terminates in a point. Before that, the all arches that they were using to build cathedrals were rounded. This is the Normanesque arch. And they figured out in the Middle Ages that if you made the tops of an arch pointed, it could hold a lot more weight and they could build things higher. So Cram was like, this is the best thing to build churches out of. He's probably not cool to hang out with. I was just saying, like, lots of strong opinions, very fussy. Like hanging out with Mark Roger Graves.
we find each other.
But his thesis was that the Renaissance had been a mistake.
I like him already.
I know. I like him already. Just love it. Yeah. And particularly the kind of, like, he bristled at the Gilded Age modernism that he was living in.
Interesting.
Because he's like basically the underlying assumption of that era of modernity was that newer was better and that everything was just going to sort of progress into newness and get better and better by virtue of its chronology.
Yeah.
And Cram's like, if we really want to do it right, we need to return to the old ways and then re-engage society going back through the classical patterns of the medieval era and particularly architecturally the Gothic era. So here's the thing. All right, you're like, so he's an architect. Great. Lots of people are architects. The reason I selected him as the most interesting Episcopal layperson is because Cram, in his architectural influence, was a celebrity, like a big one. He was, as a member of the Architectural Guild, also like on par with presidents, with people who were music celebrities, jazz musicians. Basically, the New York Times said he is one of the most prominent Episcopalian laymen in the country. Now, this is back when, like, the papers reported on church stuff and actually cared about it. Mm-hmm. But, like, that means all the more that the Times lifting him up and saying, if there was somebody that was really contributing to stuff, it's this guy, right? Similarly, he was on the cover of Time magazine, December 13th, 1926. Look it up. You can see him. He's got a kind of
how many architects have been on the cover of Time magazine?
How many architects, right? And he is essentially always mentioned in the same breadth of the great 20th century architects with Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm. And most people that know their stuff are like, not that Frank Lloyd Wright is overrated, but that Cram is underrated and under-remembered because Wright did all of these kind of showpiece homes, But Cram becomes like the architectural vocabulary of the United States in the early 20th century, you know? And I think he tips the scales as a most interesting superlative for me because like the vernacular of what we think of college architecture looking like, air quotes, or church architecture looking like, right? It's him. It's his work. You know, and you go into a Cram church and you're like, oh, I know that it's him. You can feel the work of his hand in it. You if you're an All Saints and Swanee, you're like, this feels differently. Yep, I get it. Feels like him. You know, there's a subtlety and an elegance to his architecture that just comes through. So the fact that he happened to be this person that was super influential in architecture and was an architect that was an international, but certainly a national celebrity as an Episcopalian who designed so many of the churches that we love and are influenced by, he's the most interesting Episcopal layperson. I think he's great. You know, he has a feast day on our church calendar. His feast is on December the 21st, and he shares it with Richard Upjohn and John Lafarge, who are also, one's another architect, one is a stained glass window designer. Yeah. But I think it's cool that our church recognizes artists in the feast calendars, people that are contributing to the church, because beauty is not an extra added, you know, it's nice if you have the money for it, bolt on addition to what happens in our churches and spiritual formation. The beauty is essential to human flourishing. And when it's deployed in church architecture, it changes people and it grows them into more love of Jesus and more faithful witness. So Cram's work's important and remains important, and because it makes us better. So that's why he is, to my mind, the most interesting Episcopal layperson.
Thank you, Dixon.
You're welcome.
I do think that's one of the big sort of calls for lay people is how do I as a lay person take my skills and use them to build up like the kingdom here on earth?
Yes.
Or how do I use, you know, my architecture degree or whatever to do work. And that seems like something that is really can be a challenge and an interesting process for a layperson in the church. So I can see that.
I mean, Jason, I think you bear witness to this in your work all the time. I mean, you bring beauty to all of the publications that we do, but also to the campus, to like our common life together. And it's not because it's nice or whatever, like it matters, you know? And I think you contribute, that is the gift that you give the whole church. And when you teach other people how to be like visual communicators, you know, it's not just the pragmatics of like, here's how to do, you know, effective signage.
Right.
You know, it's like, it needs to be beautiful because the beauty is essential to its survival.
Right. I do feel like I can imagine being at a party and they're like, oh dude, that's Cram over there. Don't talk about the Renaissance.
He'll go off.
Anything else? It's not the Renaissance. Thank you, Jason. Mark, are you nervous?
No. I mean, let me Dang just it. Say, Dixon, I'm really glad you showed up today. With your, you know, that is, well, you know, well done, sir.
Thank you. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, I. You know, as someone for whom beauty is a theological category, I appreciate every single thing you said. And Ralph Adams Cram is definitely, there's a reason why he's in our calendar.
Amen.
He is a worthy contender. He is definitely a couple of notches above Courtney Cox. And there's a perfect segue. What you just said is the natural segue into what I'm going to talk and who I'm going to talk about. And there's actually a great connection between our two people. Because I've got a big New Yorker on my list, and the Cathedral of St. John the Divine features in my person.
Before you begin, though, I'm trying to be aware of the people who listen who aren't from here. Remind us and the listeners what you do here at St. Paul's.
So I direct the children's choirs here at St. Paul's, which is a wonderful full-time job that I love doing, and it keeps me on my toes. It keeps me in lots of different places in the life of our church in a really cool way.
Yeah. Great.
So it Well, I know we're throwing around, you know, Courtney Cox's, but that brings up an interesting point that it's easy to go on. You can go online, and you know it's very easy to find lists of people who just happen to be Episcopalians. Yeah. And you know, and you could just find this. It's a who's who. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about Humphrey Bogart. Mm. Think about Andy McDowell for, you know, think about, you know,
Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Just a who's who of people,
celebrities
who incidentally are Episcopalian, some of whom didn't care about the fact that they were born into the Episcopal Church, Humphrey Bogart, others who found it along the way as adults or who, you know, I think about Duke Ellington. I don't think Duke Ellington ever officially was confirmed an Episcopalian, but he definitely associated in a very significant way with the Episcopal. So lots of interesting people, scare quotes, interesting, famous celebrity type people. But I wanted to make sure that I dug into a person, and I have to be fair to Dixon. I would put Cram in this category. He was not incidentally an Episcopalian. His work flowed from his faith.
I agree. Yep.
As did the person I'm going to talk about. This person wasn't just coincidentally an Episcopalian. This person was someone for whom their identity in the Episcopal Church informed their public life in a very significant way. And before I name this person, I want to offer you a prayer that she wrote.
Oh, wow.
That apparently this was her prayer every night of her adult life. Before she went to bed, she would pray this prayer. Our Father, who has set a restlessness in our hearts and made us all seekers after that which we can never fully find, forbid us to be satisfied with what we make of life. Draw us from base content and set our eyes on far-off goals. Keep us at tasks too hard for us that we may be driven to thee for strength. Deliver us from fretfulness and self-pitying. Make us sure of the good we cannot see and of the hidden good in the world. Open our eyes to simple beauty all around us and our hearts to the loveliness men hide from us because we do not try to understand them. Save us from ourselves and show us a vision of a world made new. Nice. Amen.
Yeah, that's solid.
That's
that could be in the prayer book.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a shame that it's not yet. Dixon, do you know who this person is?
I have a guess.
So this is...
I have a wrinkling wondering.
Mm. That prayer was written by none other than Anna Eleanor Roosevelt Roosevelt.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor Roosevelt, a child of the Diocese of New York, of New York Society, the niece of President Theodore Roosevelt, was baptized in Calvary Church in Manhattan and was confirmed in Calvary Church in Manhattan. The rector of Calvary Church at the time who baptized her was a priest by the name, there's all sorts of, I mean, everybody knows everybody and is connected. This is the Episcopal Church after all. Was a priest by the name of, where did it go? Don't run away from me yet. Henry Yates Satterley.
Okay.
If the name Henry Yates Satterley rings a bell, it's because he became the first bishop of the Diocese of Washington and was responsible for beginning the construction of the Cathedral Church of St. Peter and St. Paul, affectionately known as our National Cathedral.
Or not affectionately.
The Cathedral Church in the Diocese of Washington. That's Henry Yates Satterley. He baptized Eleanor Roosevelt. Wow. Her uncle, Teddy Roosevelt, laid the cornerstone for the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine, Ralph Adams Cram designed building. And so she was connected to the development of that cathedral in New York City. She was, through her life, connected to a number of Episcopal parishes that she did not just have a passing interest in. She was involved in the life of the church. She catechized her whole household, her children and her household staff. She was very interested in making sure that they were involved in the catechism, following the instructions of the 1892 prayer book, which suggests for householders to make sure that they do that. She did. By all accounts, she had most of the New Testament memorized.
Jeez.
And would frequently quote from the New Testament. And this informed everything she did in her adult life. I wonder, no one has ever said this that I have come across. And this may be an unfair statement to make, but I can't help but wondering that if she was born in 1885.
Okay.
And it makes one wonder if she had been born in 1985, would she have gone to seminary?
Yeah.
It's possible.
Curious.
It's possible. Yeah. But that was not a door that was open to her. But she realized that living her life in light of how she understood the gospel was a door that was open to her. And the way that it was open was in public life. She never ran for or was elected to political office. So we consider her to be a politician largely by virtue of her family.
Yeah.
She married Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was involved in congressional life from the state of New York and was later the president, four-term president. And she transformed the role of the first lady when she was the first lady, made it into how we see the first lady of the United States today, a very public figure whose life and energy is given to the public good. And she embodied that in so many ways and was tireless in her work for the poor, for the unemployed during the Great Depression, she went down into coal mines in West Virginia with coal miners. And this was not just a photo opportunity. This was something that she passionately cared about. She created these camps for orphans and for unemployed people in rural Appalachia. She was invested in women's rights. She was invested in the lives of African Americans in the South during Jim Crow. She was very invested in passing legislation to outlaw lynching in the South, made her very unpopular with Southern Democrats who had elected her husband to office. But she didn't care. She knew what she was doing was for justice and the healing of the world. And it all was from her place of being a person of faith, having grown up in the Episcopal Church. Here's a little bit of trivia for you. Speaking of a father-in-law who is a Civil War general, I'll see your Civil War general and raise you. The priest who married Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt was a priest by the name of Endicott Peabody, who...
It's a fake name.
It's a great name. He was the headmaster at the Groton School, and he actually founded about three different prep schools in New England and the upper Mid-Atlantic region. And then he was sent to be a missionary vicar at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Tombstone, Arizona. He arrived in Tombstone to work at St. Paul's 6 months after the shootout at the OK Corral.
Oh, wow.
The Earp family donated land to St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Tombstone, Arizona.
So weird.
While the Reverend Peabody, you know, who would then later marry Eleanor and Theodore
Can you
Roosevelt.
Imagine, like, sending a stewardship brochure to the Earps. Hey guys, how's it going?
He's like, drop it off and run away.
Exactly. It's as fast as possible, just tiptoeing.
Well, and I found a quote about this guy, Endicott Peabody, who just was invested in the life of Tombstone in Arizona. Here's the best part. He was also known to be an avid baseball fan.
Okay.
And a journalist in the newspaper said that on the field he was a daisy. So I think about when our good friend Doc Holliday would say, "You ain't no daisy." Well, here we go. Someone who was a daisy. Anyway, back to Eleanor Roosevelt. her life did not fade into retirement, into the background, when her husband died in 1945. If anything, it got more active. And she was ready to retire, and President Truman said, no, you're going to be the very first United States representative to the United Nations, which she decided finally. She was of two. She really didn't want to do it at first, and then finally said, you know what? Somebody gave her some advice that said, when the president asks you to do something, it's never a good idea to say no. And she realized that there was opportunity there to help to continue to further the things that she cared about, for justice, for working for the poor, for peace in the world, all of these things. She embraced and ran with it. She later became the chair of the committee for on the United Nations for Human Rights, and was instrumental in having the Universal Declaration of Human Rights written and approved by the United Nations in 1948, and which really has kind of set the stage ever since then of what justice and the very notion of human rights, full stop, for the world today, that for her came completely out of her conviction of what does it mean to live in a Christ-like way in the world. Her marching orders for herself often came from the words of Jesus, whatsoever you do to the least of these, you have done to me. And she took that in a very literal way, hence all her concern for African Americans. She got into not so private fights with her husband on more than one occasion during World War II, when the whole situation of internment camps for Japanese Americans became a reality. She was not happy with this and tried unsuccessfully to have that not happen, but it remains something that she was very adamant about. I already mentioned that, you know, the unemployed and the miners in Appalachia and all of these things stemmed from that. Whatsoever you do unto the least of these, that was her personal, you know, marching orders for herself. I found this wonderful article from the Anglican Examiner, which is a newsletter from the Diocese of New York, about her. And there's this wonderful line. This was written by a person named Don Mitchell. So credit goes to Don Mitchell for writing this article about Eleanor Roosevelt. Yes.
Thanks, big guy.
There is a passage in the Gospel according to Luke in which Jesus assures his disciples that at the moment of trial, he will give them words and a wisdom that none of their opponents will be able to withstand or contradict. That's kind of what happened with her when she was at the United Nations attempting to get this Universal Declaration of Human Rights done and passed and approved. She met a lot of resistance for some of the things in that text. And she did not stand down. She stood firm and largely by the strength of her will saw that come to light and to reality. One of the things I was struck by in this prayer of hers that she wrote, her personal prayer, was how there are echoes of this prayer in our prayer book. There is the prayer of thanksgiving that we occasionally do that has the line, we thank you for setting us at tasks that demand our best efforts and for leading us to accomplishments which satisfy and delight us. We also thank you for those disappointments and failures that lead us to acknowledge our dependence on you alone. That's a lot like some of the phrasing she had in her prayer about give us things that are too hard for us to do.
Yeah.
And we can learn from those too. She wrote almost 20 books, this one.
Wow.
She found time to write I think it's like 19 books under her name or something like that.
Wow.
One of which from 1940 is called, I don't want to say the name of the book wrong. The Moral Basis of Democracy, which is a fascinating book. I've only read excerpts from, but basically in The Moral Basis of Democracy, and this is very Episcopalian in its ethos, she basically argues that a society to be moral, and for a democratic society to be moral, its members do not have to be Christian. society doesn't have to be Christian, but it does need to be Christ-like. And she makes that distinction. You know, there's this sense that, you know, like our motto at St. Paul's, it's the same motto at St. John the Divine in New York City, at the National Cathedral, a house of prayer for all people.
Yeah.
And that the witness and life and death and resurrection and ministry of Jesus reaches out and touches everyone in the world, whether they personally are invested in his divinity as a Christian or not, he nevertheless has that gift to the world. And she really understood that that gift that Jesus gave us both in his life and his witness, in her words, was that's a successful life. That cruciform shaped life, even for a civic secular society, is the life of true success. And it's just a remarkable way that she found to live that out in a very public way. And she was not ashamed to say that was where she got her inspiration from, was her own faith. Wow. So therefore, the most interesting lay Episcopalian, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Thank you, Mark.
It's pretty solid.
That is a good, that is a hard to disagree with pick.
Wait, you can't put your thumb on the scale like that. You can't already. I will say I love it was a line where you were moving from one thing to another, but I think it's really important in this conversation today where you talked about how she recognized the doors that were open to her were this influence in public life.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Well, you reminded me of something I was going to say. So thank you. But yes, the doors that, and also she, I think she's a great example for us in our church of ways of recognizing privilege and her own privilege. I mean, she was a gilded child of the Gilded Age. Yeah. She was a Roosevelt among Roosevelts and recognized that that allowed her to have a particular platform and a particular microphone that she might otherwise not have been able to have as publicly as she did. Using, recognizing her privilege as an opportunity and using it in the way that she did.
I think
pretty
that also
remarkable.
That makes that prayer that she wrote more interesting too.
Yeah.
To put it in the context of her understanding her privilege.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting.
But I would, and the other category I would give to it is philosopher Jacques Ellul talks about the avenues of power, which is a similar sort of construct where he was like, Christians, you just live in the world, but like there are doors that are open to you. You have avenues of power. So whatever you've been given, you use that to be faithful and be Christ-like, you know, for the healing of the world.
Hmm.
And if I could get just a little sentimental, all three of you in the room, Chris is also in here, Jason's
husband.
Our
sound engineer, Chris Martin, also my husband.
Like you are all three such powerful witnesses of faithful lay ministry in this church.
Hmm.
Like all of you are like, here's the gift I have to give. How do I give it in the church? You know, and it does not require a collar. In fact, like, I'm glad you don't have a collar because the church, like, they need your stuff way more than me right now. You know, like I do my part, like we talk about the roles, but like, thank each of you for the ways that you do that faithfully, you witness to it, and the way that you create beauty. All of you create beauty with your gifts, which is another vote for Cram because beauty matters. But it's true. And so just thank you for all of you for
thank
the
you,
way Dixon. You do that. It's just thank so cool to be in this with you.
Yeah, we are awesome, aren't we?
I think so.
We're pretty awesome.
Yeah. Power to the people. Yeah. Thank you, Dixon.
Thank you, Dixon. Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate this conversation. It was great. Friends, the cases have been presented for the most interesting layperson in the Episcopal Church. And now the power is in your hands.
The avenue of power.
The avenue of power. Is it Eleanor Roosevelt or Ralph Adam Cram? Let us know. If you're listening on Spotify, there is a link to a poll in the episode description where you can vote. Season 2 is officially underway, and we have a bunch of great episodes coming. Check back every Thursday on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please do all the things. Rate, like, and subscribe if you enjoy the show. If you don't, just disregard what I just said. And you can visit St. Paul's and see what it's like to worship with Ralph Adams Cram's buildings by learning more information at stpaulsws.org. If you have any show ideas and you want to reach out to me personally, my email is jason@stpaulswinstonsalem.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening and voting. We'll see you later. Bye.